Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another edition of CMC Radio. I'm your host, Rob May. Hope everyone's having a great week so far. It is Wednesday, 4 p.m. here on the East Coast in New York. And as I mentioned, you know, it's the middle of the work week now. We're halfway there, guys. So hopefully everyone's got some good plans going on for the weekend. And the work week treats you right. So joining me today, very excited to have on the show, Mr. John Campbell. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
All right. So, John, a little bit about yourself, just to kind of familiarize us. You know, I'm very excited to discuss some of the topics that I see that your areas of expertise are. I really want to know, you know, kind of a little bit about yourself, though. Tell us a little bit.
I was born and raised just outside of Washington, D.C. My academic work was in British and French history, with a particular focus on Tudor Stuart English history. I taught for 5 years at a small college down in Virginia. And then, on something of a lark, I took the Foreign Service exam. To my surprise, I passed it. I went into the Foreign Service, where I served for more than 30 years. After I retired from the Foreign Service, I went to the University of Wisconsin as a visiting professor, and then from there to the Council on Foreign Relations, where I had been for the past 7 years. At the Council on Foreign Relations, I am the Ralph Bunch Fellow for Africa Policy Studies, and I have focused particularly on Nigeria and South Africa, and now increasingly on radical Islamist fundamentalist movements in West Africa.
Okay, so let me ask you this then real quick. How did you, who kind of inspired you or influenced you to follow this path?
Well, when you're born and raised in Washington, there's nothing unusual about Foreign Service officers or diplomats. For example, when I was in elementary and middle school, some of the kids there were the children of British, Canadian, Danish, Swedish diplomats. So in other words, it wasn't something that sort of dropped out of the sky. It was always a kind of alternative that you could follow. And
right.
It was an alternative to me that became particularly interesting because, frankly, the academic job market essentially was drying up, which meant while I liked the small college I was teaching at, it was unlikely I was going to be able to move from it anytime soon. So I thought, why not give the Foreign Service a try?
Sure. Absolutely. And so you said Africa is a primary focus, right?
It is, but that was sort of by chance.
Mm-hmm.
My academic background is in the history of Britain and France. My early assignments in the Foreign Service basically involved Britain and France. And I was sitting one day before Christmas in my office in Geneva. I'd recently been promoted. The Christmas holidays were coming up, and I felt very much like a self-satisfied fat cat. The phone rang, and it was the Director General of the Foreign Service. Now, the Director General of the Foreign Service is an exalted personage whom I had never met, so I immediately stood up. And over the phone came, in the sort of soft North Carolina accent, him saying, "Now, John, I don't want you to say no until you've heard me out." And the result is I'm one of the few people in the Foreign Service who curtailed an assignment to Geneva, Switzerland, one of the loveliest cities in the world,
mm-hmm.
to go to Lagos, Nigeria, which is not normally described as one of the loveliest cities in the world.
Right.
And once I got there, I found the place fascinating. And was thoroughly bitten by the Africa bug, but
mm-hmm.
that was almost halfway through my career. So,
wow.
So that's what got me really hooked.
Sure. So what was it about what you saw there that really pulled you in?
First of all, the complexity. It takes a real effort to figure out what's going on in any African country. Who really runs it? Who really benefits from it?
Right.
So intellectually, really demanding. Secondly, the Nigerians are very, very open. They take you just exactly as you are, and they expect you to do the same thing with them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's quite funny. They will ask you questions that, from an American perspective, are unbelievably personal. Why aren't you married?
Right.
that sort of thing. But on the other hand, they expect you to do the same with them. So it's a very fun place to be and to work.
So what is it that you do in your work? I mean, what's the daily routine like for you?
Okay. Basically, what I do is, in a sense, similar to what I did when I was later ambassador to Nigeria, and that is speaking and writing. Here at the council, every day, I do a blog post on Africa, and gathering the materials, fact-checking, and posting it takes normally an hour and a half to 2 hours. Then I'm usually involved in preparation for a speech, and I give speeches sort of, you know, all around the country, generally on African subjects, and with a particular focus on Nigeria and South Africa. And then when you're at the Council on Foreign Relations, you are always involved with writing a book. And I did a book on Nigeria called Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, which came out in 2011, and then a second edition came out in 2013. And I have a book on South Africa called Mourning in South Africa. That's M-O-R-N-I-N-G. And that will be on the shelves in May. So it's writing, speaking. I also talk to pretty much anybody who wants to talk to me about what's going on in Africa.
So let me ask you this then, and before, because I do want to discuss the books, obviously, but what is going on in Africa right now? I know you mentioned the fundamentalism. You know, how extreme is it? You know, compared to other areas, is it something that the rest of the world really needs to focus on?
Yeah, the rest of the world does need to focus on it. The fundamentalism in West Africa can be sort of basically divided into two camps. One is associated with Al-Qaeda. They're the people who launched insurrections in Mali, for example. They tend to be internationalist, bitterly hostile to the West. The other, the much larger one, is Boko Haram, centered in northern Nigeria, and with some very weak ties to the Islamic State, ties that I don't think mean very much. But the interesting thing about that is Boko Haram is a threat to U.S. interests, but not to U.S. security. It's a threat to U.S. interests because our interests are in a stable and successful Nigeria, a stable and successful West Africa. But Boko Haram isn't terribly interested in the United States as the United States. It's, for example, it's never attacked an American facility. It's really never attacked a Western facility. So its orientation tends to be much more inward-looking than the Al-Qaeda associated groups in West in Senegal or in Mali.
Right. But now, I mean, obviously there's been extremism across the globe for years upon years. Has there been more in that particular area, though, would you say, in the last couple of years?
I would yes, there has been more. It has increased. But what is particularly different about Africa, or West Africa, is that the states are weaker than they are in other places, which means that radical groups can often grow more rapidly. They can ground themselves more easily than in places that have stronger governments.
How does the governments of Nigeria and West Africa combat this right now? I mean, is it clearly it's not working, obviously, if you're saying it's increasing, right?
Yeah, it's not working. Basically, what they're doing is that they're treating it as something that you can solve militarily. You know, you can go after Boko Haram with the army and with the police and so forth. I would suggest that, yeah, you have to do that in order to restore a sense of security. But what you really have to do is address the fundamental problems that drive support for groups like Boko Haram. That's poor governance, weak economy, increasing impoverishment, that sort of thing. So you have to do it. You have to approach it, you know, both from a security perspective, but you also have to approach it from a sort of soft side.
Sure,
and
sure.
It's a soft side that the African states are particularly weak on.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there any other particular area in the world that you would say has done it right in terms of dealing with extremism?
Of course, they're different. But there was Sendero Luminoso in Peru, and there was also the extremism associated with the narcotics trade in Colombia. And in both of those cases, the countries involved found a formula that was, as it were, a mixture of carrot and stick that seems to have worked pretty well. Examples of where it hasn't worked, Somalia is a classic example of where it hasn't worked.
Yeah.
And then one could certainly argue it hasn't worked in the Middle East. I mean, ISIS is still there.
I don't think you would get any argument there. So it's very unfortunate, but yeah, I can't see anyone arguing that anything has really been too effective there yet.
That's right. That's right. And again, the approach is basically that of military. I mean, you know, bombing them.
All right.
And yet, the awful reality is that, like Boko Haram, the Islamic State has a degree of popular support, no matter how abhorrent it is to us.
Right. That's very true, which actually brings me to my next question about the state of the world, really. I mean, you've obviously seen a lot of different things go on in the course of your career. Would you say that now is a more hostile environment than in the past?
Well, it's a really interesting question. When I was in elementary school, we had regular bomb drills. In which, you know, as a 7 or 8 year old, we had to crouch under our desks because of the real fear and concern of a war between the West and the Soviet Union, a war that could involve, almost certainly would involve, nuclear weapons.
Mm.
Now, that's pretty scary, and yet we certainly don't have that now. So in that
sense, do you think it's something that can happen, though?
I think it's highly unlikely, unlikely. Whereas in the 1950s and 1960s, it wasn't unlikely. And then what happened? Well, the Soviet Union collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet Union collapsed when actually I was serving in Nigeria the first time. And I got the first inkling that something interesting was happening when the Soviet political counselor called me up on the phone and invited me to go to the Soviet embassy and get a debrief on the visit of the Soviet foreign minister to Nigeria.
Hmm.
Now, this never happened. This was a really something radically new and different. that the Soviets would be reaching out for a dialogue with the American embassy in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that was an extraordinary development. Now, and finally, an extraordinarily positive development. So, you know, we've got terrorism now. We have weak states now, weak states then, but we don't have the threat of nuclear war. And that's an enormously important reality.
Right. I would have to agree. I mean, you know, it's, as you mentioned, it feels like as tense as things are everywhere, I don't think they are quite as bad maybe as the way that they were once.
That's right. I agree. And, of course, again, in those days, we all grossly overestimated Soviet power.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads me, I guess, to another observation, and that is it's always interesting how little we actually know. We were talking a few minutes ago about Boko Haram.
Right.
We don't know how Boko Haram is structured. We don't know who its real leader is. There's a person by the name of Abubakar Shekau who's the sort of face of Boko Haram, but we don't know how much power he actually has. We don't know if there's a council. There's no real consensus as to whether Boko Haram is actually fundamentally a populist uprising or whether really fundamentally a terrorist organization. So, you know, there were lots of things we didn't know back in the 1950s and 1960s, and that should caution us against arrogance now, against assuming that we know perhaps more than we really do about Islamic radicalism, for example.
Sure, absolutely. It's a scary state, I'll tell you that, either way. You know, there's a lot of different ways for it to be handled, but you know,
I agree.
It's one of the, absolutely. Now, John, I know that we wanted to focus a little bit of our time more on some of the books that you've written. So please, why don't you tell us exactly a little bit more about Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, your first published work?
Well, basically what I wanted to do was call attention to just how important Nigeria was. When that book came out, we were importing 1 million barrels of oil a day from Nigeria. And I was concerned that Nigeria wasn't getting nearly enough attention in the United States, and that essentially, because of internal reasons, the Nigerian state was in trouble, hence Dancing on the Brink. My second book, Morning in South Africa, looks at South Africa 21 years after Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as president, after apartheid was dismantled. And what it tries to do is assess the current South African government, which has many, many faults, but at the same time, the way democratic institutions have strengthened in that country. Hence, the Nigeria book in many ways was pessimistic. The South Africa book in many ways is optimistic.
So when it came to the writing process, how did your approach change between the two?
And that was something I really had to think about. Nigeria Dancing on the Brink draws very heavily from my time as ambassador to Nigeria. And in fact, I wrote the first draft of it while I was at the University of Wisconsin the year immediately after I left Nigeria. The second book, Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, that too draws from personal experience because I was head of the embassy political section during the transition from apartheid to non-racial democracy. And so I personally knew all the players, F.W. de Klerk, Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Tutu. So there was an important personal dimension there. But I had been I'd gone back to South Africa any number of times, but I had not been living there just before I wrote the first draft of Morning in South Africa. So Morning in South Africa, I had to use more of the conventional research approaches that you do when you're trying to do a book on another country. And particularly when you're trying to do a book that's not intended for specialists, but instead is intended for a mass audience of people who might have some interest in Africa, but don't have a kind of specialist background.
Right.
So what you have to do is figure out what they really need to know to appreciate what you're trying to say.
Absolutely.
And that's
sure.
And that's a different challenge, and it's a lot of fun.
You treat it as a fun challenge. That's
oh yeah. Oh sure. Because you're trying to put yourself in your audience's shoes.
Sure. And as far as general feedback goes, then from the first work, at least, how has that been for you?
Oh, well, that was very interesting. In the U.S. and in the U.K., it was well received. In Nigeria, the then government hated it.
Right.
Opponents to the government liked it. And, of course, those opponents are now the government. So right now, I'm told, the book is well received in Nigeria.
It's funny how
an election can
like
change
that.
Things.
Everything, right?
That's right. That's right.
We'll,
now,
we'll be seeing,
my South
and
Africa
we'll be seeing
book.
That shortly, too.
What's that?
I said we'll be seeing that in this country, too, I'm sure.
Oh, indeed we will. Indeed we will. Yeah. Now, with my South Africa book, the general sort of atmosphere in Cape Town, Johannesburg, and Pretoria
mm-hmm.
is that the government is a mess. And I agree, the government is a mess. But I'm arguing that the institutions, democratic institutions, are stronger than they were. They're much more important. And any democracy can go through a period of time in which the government is a mess.
Right.
I can even think of one or two fairly close at hand.
So that book... Yeah.
That book is, as it were, unfashionable because it goes against the current conventional wisdom.
Sure. And you don't have any hesitation to do something like that?
Oh, no, absolutely not. One of the great things about being at the council is that you are absolutely independent. You can
mm-hmm.
say exactly what you think.
Uh-huh. Well, that must be a great power to have then, especially
it
when
is.
You want
well, it,
when
it,
you're putting
it's
out.
It's a great privilege.
Different... Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, in your experience with being in Africa, would you say that do people in that country dare have that privilege to speak against, or is it more of outsiders that are allowed to do that?
It's very interesting that you should ask that, because in the two countries I know best, Nigeria and South Africa,
right.
in both places, people are extremely outspoken and are not afraid mm-hmm. to say exactly what they think.
Right.
South Africa, being far more developed, has means of expression similar to what we have in the U.S. In other words, there's a dynamic press, there are book publishing houses, there are journals. In that sense, it very much resembles the U.S. In Nigeria, media outlets are much less developed. And the concern there is that a local big man doesn't like what a newspaper says about something.
Mm-hmm.
The big man will get a mob together and go and burn down the newspaper headquarters. In other words,
right.
it's a kind of lawlessness
right.
as opposed to official government policy.
Sure.
Government policy is absolute freedom of speech in both countries.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, as far as I know, your books That, I mean, your first one and your second one is going to be available everywhere. People can pick them up on Amazon and all sorts
yep.
of different outlets and you know, as you mentioned, you know, in bookstores. Do you ever come across somebody that reads your book and comes at you, you know, to kind of say, you know, you came off wrong or anything like that, you know?
Oh, yes. Kind of... Oh, yes, indeed. With Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, which
right.
the then government hated, it got two or three academics, Nigerian academics, to write round denunciations of it. In fact, the rhetoric of the denunciations is really quite funny. It's over the top.
And
quite
so,
funny.
So you treat that more as a, I mean, not so much a threat, obviously. I mean, against anything that you're trying to do, but more of just them, the traditional way of thinking, just not really accepting, you know, what reality is there.
That's right. And further, I was in a weird sort of way. Gratified because it meant, gee, somebody was paying attention to it. They were actually reading
right.
it.
Sure.
And then, of course, there were plenty of other Nigerians who liked it quite a lot and wrote very positive reviews about it and provided me with a lot of support.
That's great. And for all those just joining us a little late now into the show, as we have about 3.5 minutes left with John Campbell, of the Council on Foreign Relations and an author as well with two books soon to be out. One already, Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, available everywhere. And the second book, again, is Mourning. What's the official title?
In South Africa.
Mourning
in South Africa.
So, John, you know, in terms of what you hope people do actually take away from the new book now, what is it that you really want them to understand?
Okay, what I really want them to understand is, well, to back up, when Nelson Mandela came to office, and then later when he died, he was the focus of intense American interest. That interest then fell away. I'm arguing that interest should be rekindled, that South Africa is an important country in Africa. It could be an important partner of ours, and it's intrinsically a fascinating place. Secondly, I'm arguing that the strength of South Africa's democratic institutions, after hundreds of years of white supremacy and racism, the strength of those institutions should tell us about the potential strength of democratic institutions in other countries that are not yet democratic. So the book is optimistic.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's clearly optimistic, though? I mean, obviously you said you're going to hit people that are going to go one way or the other sometimes, but do you think that you clearly got across your message?
I hope so. I hope so.
Right.
That was certainly the intention of it. And I make perfectly clear that the present government is a mess.
Sure. Absolutely.
But
right.
I also maintain
well,
South Africa is a lot more than the present government.
Right. Which I think is important for people to understand about every nation, I think, right? I mean, you
yes.
put so much time and energy into developing a culture, developing your own being, that you should stand for more than just the government. I mean, obviously the government should go hand in hand with that culture, but oftentimes it doesn't.
That's right, and that's particularly true in democracies.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, I do want to thank you for coming on to the show today. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, and I hope that we can get you back on in the near future to find out a little bit more, you know, see how everything's going for you. If you'd like, please let people know how they can reach out to you, find out some more information about you, the books, and all that.
Best thing to do is to go to my website. You will find it under cfr.org and go to Campbell. And there it all is.
All right. Well, John, again, thank you so much for coming on to the show today, and we hope to hear from you soon. And good luck with everything.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
All righty. From everyone here at CMC Radio, this is Rob May saying we'll see you soon. Thanks for listening, everybody.